Carlucci reports the deal is being met with some skepticism.
Best Buy has had its share of troubles. An affair with an employee forced out its CEO earlier this year. Schultz, who founded the company nearly half a century ago, also resigned after he failed to disclose the affair. Apart from that, Best Buy struggles to manage its roster of giant stores as it loses business to web-based competition. RJ Hadavi, an analyst with Morningstar, says it's not clear from Schultz's open letter that he has the answer.
There wasn't a lot of information in the proposal letter itself about what Schultz plans to do with the business.
Michael Pachter is an analyst with Wedbush Securities who believes the company's current business approach is fatal.
There is no reason for a dedicated specialty retailer selling commodity products. And that is exactly what Best Buy is.
In his statement, Schultz discussed how he plans to finance a deal, but not how he would save the company that sells everything from TVs to washers.
If he had a better idea of how to turn the company around, one would think that would have surfaced in his 45 years on the board of directors.
For its part, Best Buy said it will consider the offer. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
What our presidents and candidates eat says a lot about the public images they strive to project. Historically, their recipes also gave us insight into the cooking advancements and habits of the period. In this heated political season, when all things presidential are scrutinized, stump speeches, fundraisers, fashion choices, we thought it fitting to consider presidents and food. President Bill Clinton famously loved donuts on the campaign trail. George Washington was known to eat his wife Martha's crab soup. Chris Kimball of Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen tells NPR's Renee Montaigne you can learn a lot about a president or a candidate based on what he eats.
And you can tell something about the First Lady. You can also tell something about the time, their era, because very often the recipes are very much part of that historic period.
And you provide us with several historical recipes, starting with one from way back, 1809, the White House of President James Madison. Tell us about that recipe.
Well, it's Dolly Madison's favorite cake. It's a layer cake that has a caramel icing. Caramel icings were very popular in the 1800s. Dolly Madison invented the concept of the First Lady, at least for 200 years. And cakes, layer cakes, were really the consummate test of one's cooking skills. She was also acted really as First Lady under Thomas Jefferson. He was a widower. So she had plenty of experience by the time she got there with her own husband, James Madison.
And I'm looking over at what I take to be this layer cake. It's actually four layers.
Yeah, it's an interesting cake because originally cakes were yeasted for leavening before chemical leaveners. And this cake leavened through beaten egg whites, which they used for many decades as the way of getting lift into a cake. So it'll be a little more dense than what you're used to with a modern cake with baking powder.
I'm looking at this array of food, and right here to my left, there's this lovely yellow drink with a lemon in it, but this does not taste like lemonade. What exactly is this?
Well, it's a squall, which is similar to a squash, and this is during Prohibition. This is Warren Harding. The First Lady, Mrs. Harding, gave large parties on the lawn of the White House. And during the 1800s and early 20th century, it was not acceptable for women to be drinking alcohol in public, so they invented these non-alcoholic punches. This one is kind of interesting. You take a whole pineapple, you take the skin off, and you put it through, quote-unquote, a meat grinder. That's what they used to pulp it. And so you put the pulp and juice together with some boiled lemon rind and lemon juice and a lot of sugar. And this was the acceptable drink for ladies. My guess is more than one lady snuck a little gin into their squall, I think, during those afternoon parties. And Warren Harding himself in the White House during Prohibition had a very well-stocked liquor cabinet. So there was no lack of alcohol in the White House during Prohibition.
Here on your list is a recipe from a later president, Harry Truman, 1945-1953. It's Ozark pudding.
Yeah, this is fascinating. FDR, sort of this princely aristocratic president. And then you get Harry Truman, who's a man of the people, Missouri, the Midwest, very down to earth. His wife, Bess, came into the White House, watched every penny in terms of expenses and food. Ozark pudding, it's a little bit like a pudding cake. It's sweet, and it has nuts in it, usually walnuts and apples. And we made a couple versions. The less sweet the apples, the better the Ozark pudding. It's an odd dish, but we loved it.
This does look very plain.
That was Harry Truman. That was his charm. You know, by the way, he invented one of the great culinary aphorisms, which was, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Well, you know, for as sweet as it is, it's my favorite.
It's actually quite good.
Now, so far, so sweet. But judging by the recipes and what I'm looking at on the table, it seems like several presidents had a thing for seafood, starting with George Washington.
Yeah, George Washington did have that crab soup. William Taft, he was our largest president at 350 pounds. And his recipe was Billy B, which a guy called William Brandt, which became Billy B for Brandt, loved mussels, but he didn't like eating them. So he said, look, make me a soup with mussel liqueur, you know, the juice from the mussels, which they did. And it became really the signature dish for Taft. Kennedy loved his lobster stew. And the thing that was a bit quirky about JFK was he liked lobster stew, but not the lobster. So he drank the liquid. And very often the person he was dining with would actually end up eating the lobster.
And there is another recipe that you have, different president, that caused some controversy. That's Nancy Reagan's crab meat and artichoke casserole.
Oh, this was a huge dust-up at the time. There was a woman from Chicago, Susan Benjamin. She had two kids with special needs. She wrote the White House and said, please don't cut funding for special needs. And the PR department of the White House didn't read the letter and just sent her back a few pictures of Ron and Nancy and a few recipes. One of the recipes, unfortunately, was Nancy Reagan's crab meat and artichoke casserole. And many newspaper pieces were written about sending this poor woman a recipe that was only for rich people because it required crab meat. And there were lines about, you know, how can a man who wears $1,000 cowboy boots, you know, be in touch with the people? And so this has obviously echoes of today.
Okay, let's look at a couple of current recipes then. How about the Obama family macaroni and cheese with a twist?
Both candidates have learned their lesson. So both of these recipes are very much of the people. Michelle, of course, is a huge promoter of the White House garden and of vegetables. And so she actually makes a sauce based upon puree cooked cauliflower, reduces the amount of cheese, and comes up with a mac and cheese with a nice smooth sauce, but has a couple hundred calories less and about half the fat. And actually, it's quite good.
What about Ann Romney? What does she make for Mitt Romney?
The one recipe that she talks about most is actually really interesting. It's a recipe I'd never heard of, Welsh skillet cakes. And these are currant scones. And they do go back to her grandmother from Wales. And they used to make them on top of a coal stove or on a bake stone, they called it. And they were cooked on a griddle. They weren't baked in the oven. They were like pasties, you know, they were sort of out-of-hand food miners would bring down when they worked, and they're quite good.
Chris, thank you for sharing these presidential food favorites with us.
A pleasure, and maybe it's time we elected a chef to be president.
Chris Kimball of Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen, he spoke with NPR's Renee Montaigne. British chemist Martin Fleischmann, who stunned the world by announcing that he had created a nuclear fusion device in a glass bottle, has died after a long illness. He was 85 years old. His son Nicholas says he died Friday at his home in Tisbury, England. He had suffered from Parkinson's disease for many years. Fleischmann was one of the world's leading electrochemists when he and partner Stanley Ponz proclaimed in 1989 that they had achieved fusion, the nuclear process that heats the sun, in an experiment at the University of Utah. Other scientists rushed to replicate the achievement, but most failed, and cold fusion was quickly labeled junk science by some. However, work on similar experiments has continued on the fringes of the scientific world. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580.
Support comes from Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 contemporary and traditional guaranteed hand-knotted rugs made of pure wool or silk pile, from contemporary to traditional. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service. Eastern Rug Gallery, located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
Talk about a big city.
Wuhan has over 60 universities and roughly 1 million students.
Wuhan, China is bigger than New York City and is attracting big Western investment, but it's not nearly as well known as Shanghai or Beijing. The NPR Cities Project on the urbanization of inland China, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9. here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 7th of August, 2012. It's the birthday of the Dutch dancer and alleged spy Mata Hari, born Margaretha Zelle in Leeuwarden in the Netherlands in 1876. She married an army officer, and the two of them lived in Java and Sumatra for a few years. That's where she picked up her byname, Mata Hari, which means sunrise. They were divorced. They came back to Holland in order to make some money. She started dancing professionally in Paris and sometimes worked in a brothel. She had apparently sold some outdated information about France to the Germans in 1916, then later made a deal with the head of French intelligence to spy on the Germans in exchange for a pass to go to the Eastern War Zone and visit her Russian lover. But the French became suspicious that she was a double agent, and she was tried, convicted, and executed by firing squad in 1917, though one of her prosecutors later said there wasn't enough evidence against her to flog a cat. It was on this date, 1947, the raft Contiki finished its successful voyage from Peru to French Polynesia, a craft piloted by a Norwegian ethnologist named Thor Heyerdahl, was out to prove that early South Americans could have traveled across the Pacific and settled in the Polynesian islands. So he made his raft of pre-Columbian materials, balsa logs lashed together with hemp ropes, a cabin made of bamboo with a thatched roof of banana leaves. It made the trip in 3.5 months, and Thor Heyerdahl wrote a best-selling book about it, The Contiki Expedition. It's the birthday of Anne Fadiman, New York City, 1953, who got an assignment to write for The New Yorker about a young Hmong girl with epilepsy and her parents' difficulty dealing with the American medical system. The New Yorker turned down the piece, and so Fadiman turned it into a book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. She's also the author of a couple of collections of essays, At Large and At Small, writing about her childhood butterfly collection on the art of letter writing. And it was on this day in 1934, the U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that James Joyce's Ulysses was not obscene. It had been banned in this country in 1920. It sold very well on the black market, but James Joyce and his publisher couldn't make any money that way, so they had to fight the ban, and that required Random House to provoke the government into a new obscenity trial.